call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum. The first order of business is approval of the minutes from February 14th, 2023. Do we have a motion?
So moves, Madam Chair.
All right. Vice Chair Feist moves the minutes from February 14th, 2023. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first bill we have on our agenda today is House File 824. It is a Representative Kern bill, and she is already at the testifier table. We are going to lay over this bill, so I will move the bill in front of us. I move to lay over House File 824. Representative Kern, you, I believe, have an A2 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I would like to move my A2 amendment.
All right, and if you can please explain what the A2 amendment does.
Yes, so this amendment is a combination of input from the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Department of Corrections, and with NAMI. It's dual purpose. I know it looks really small, but what it does is it accounts for the fact that not all individuals may want to opt into discharge plans, and we had some language in there that said must, and so just to make sure there's some flexibility there for folks who don't want to participate in any or all portions of the recommended discharge plans, that the language allows for that, and a discharge plan wouldn't be forced upon an individual that doesn't want one. The other portion of it is, let's see, we had it acknowledges the need for counties to retain funds. So there's some pieces in there where the counties through the discharge plan would be assisting the person transitioning into the community, and we recognize and acknowledge that does have some funds associated with it, so we just want to make sure that we allow for that the appropriation amount to have a percent allocated that they can keep to cover those funds.
All right, thank you. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. And I think that is the only author's amendment you had. So if you wanted to go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Mueller and members, and thank you to NAMI for championing this effort. And I appreciate the work alongside DOC and counties for making this a good collaborative effort. HF 824, as amended, strengthens our transition process between incarceration and community living by adding some guidance and clarification to discharge plans. One of the biggest points of bipartisan agreement that we have had so far this session in a variety of committees surrounds the way that we acknowledge the need for a wraparound mental health services for folks. We've really been connecting on intersections between health, wealth, and the criminal justice system. And we know that everyday struggles with mental health and mental illness can lead to things like loss of relationships, jobs, good physical health, housing, and a host of all other integral pieces of our lives. And this is true for all of us as people sitting here and living in free society, and it's also true for people living in incarceration. It stands to reason then we should equip folks with the tools needed to maintain access to basic needs while transitioning between entirely different phases of life. And when a person is a responsibility of this state, I believe our state's obligated to provide for the best possible outcomes for that person. We want our neighbors to be of healthy mind and body, safe, successful, and live a crime-free life. That's the spirit of this bill, and I will turn it over to our first testifier to do a walkthrough.
All right, great, thank you. And I believe that you have some testifiers, and someone's already at the table. Elliot Butai, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members. My name is Elliot Butai. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator at NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Mental Health Legislative Network, a coalition of over 40 mental health organizations. The network worked together on a number of bills this session, and this is our criminal justice proposal. The bill focuses on supporting people in jail and when they're getting ready to leave. It's built off a bill from last session, which requires free phone calls to a mental health provider, a case manager, or a MNSURE navigator, which is really important for people to transition to care in the community. I also want to highlight that the Minnesota Warm Line is included, which is a peer support line. And like Representative Curran said, we know jails are struggling to care for people, and I believe that talking to a peer specialist could really make a difference in a person whose mental health could be going from bad to worse when they're incarcerated. So that's Section 2. Section 1, I'll jump back to the beginning, relates to the Hardell-Scharell Act, which passed in 2021, and it required new and needed standards for mental health and health care in jails. NAMI's been a part of a working group to draft those rules. But the act required the Department of Corrections to post license infractions on their website, and it was really just a small drafting error that the lowest level of infractions, correction orders, weren't included. And while correction orders are rare, when we asked the department for an example, they told us a facility was cited for well-being checks, and noncompliance with well-being checks was actually a significant reason why some experienced tragedies like Hardell-Scharell's family. So this is a measure so that there's transparency and more accountability. The third section of the bill requires an update to a model discharge plan by the Department of Corrections. This doesn't create any new mandates for counties, but it would serve as a best practice model. Subdivision 2 is a small change to ensure that people with the most serious mental illnesses are really getting special attention to transition back to the community. This is already a requirement, but this section of statute is actually almost 20 years old, and we're not really sure if counties are following it, not out of bad intent, but some might just not know that the law exists. And finally, we have other testifiers to speak to why the bill is important personally, but I did want to highlight the work of Hannah Jerebeck from McLeod County, who gathered all the contact information of all these different social worker programs around the state. And they started holding monthly meetings and bouncing ideas off of each other. And I think it's noteworthy that over 30 counties have these types of programs and positions working with incarcerated people. And that's simply because those communities have seen the need and responded. So I thank you for hearing this bill and urge your support so that these communities can continue and expand this work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Next up, we have Hannah Jerebeck, who you just mentioned. Come on up to the testifiers table. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself, and then you can begin your testimony.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Hannah Jerebeck, and I'm a licensed social worker with McLeod County Health and Human Services. About 4 years ago, we incorporated the jail reentry program into our jail. This need was identified by our jail nursing staff and jail administrator, who were becoming overwhelmed with inmates requesting resources for basic needs such as housing, medical insurance, assistance to pay bills, and a variety of other needs. Currently, our jail contracts with Health and Human Services to have this reentry program on a very part-time basis. Our current contract is about 12 hours per week, which isn't enough, and usually I go over that. Because this isn't a full-time program, I am also a case manager for our county, being pulled in many different directions, and I can't always assist our inmates in a timely manner. I assist our inmates with a variety of needs, such as chemical use assessment and treatment coordination, MNTRA applications, SNAP food, GA, and cash assistance applications, as well as housing and transportation resources, and a wide variety of other needs upon their release. Our program is voluntary. The inmate has the choice to meet with me, and I help with resources even if they don't live in our county. McLeod County is a fairly rural county, and resources can be hard to come by. So I try to assist our inmates to make connections while still incarcerated to break down some of the barriers they face upon release. With limited time to work in the jail, it's challenging to meet with every inmate to make an impact. If there would be funding for this program in every jail in the state of Minnesota, we could have full-time positions dedicated to making an impact with our justice-involved population, involving adults and juveniles to break down those barriers and bring more mental health supports in our jails. Mental health continues to be a huge challenge for this population. Sometimes I hear, well, people are safe and sober in jail, and that couldn't be further from the truth. Our jails seem to be the place that people come to not only when offense is committed, but even when someone is hospitalized for a mental health emergency and the hospital doesn't feel that they can handle their needs, they sometimes come to our jail. Not to mention when someone is in jail and needing medications for physical and or mental health needs, they have to pay for those medications because medical assistance insurance isn't active while incarcerated. Many come into custody and don't have any funds, and when they realize that they will be billed for their medications, they choose not to. It's disruptive to people when they can't stay on or even start medications because sometimes this is the first medical professional they've seen in quite a while. When people leave our jails and they are homeless and without many resources, getting them back on health insurance and any other program proves to be a huge challenge and creates a big barrier. With more resources to work with people while in custody, jails could send inmates back to the community with medication in hand and connections into treatment. please consider funding this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Next on the list is Brandon Stolt. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Mueller, members. My name is Brandon Stone. I live in the city of St. Peter here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on House File number 824. I was incarcerated in jail one time back in 2018 and then in 2020 just for one case. The first time I was taken to jail, I did not have any access to any of medications for the first 5 days I was there back in 2018. This made the already stressful situation even harder, and my mental health got worse. My case manager was one of the most supportive people in my life, and when I was sentenced to 23 days in jail in 2020, I was fortunate to be able to prepare and have some money when I went in. I knew I would need visits from my caseworker to feel supported. My case manager was able to communicate with my therapist so I wouldn't get in any trouble for missing my court-ordered therapy. They were also able to communicate with my parents and legal guardians and let them know how I was doing. When my caseworker met with me in a professional visit, I was also able to share my concerns and know that someone was listening to me. To set those meetings up, I had to call my caseworker, and that cost 50 cents a minute in the Blue Earth County Jail in Mankato. When you're talking on the phone, time moves fast. For a 20-minute call, I had to pay $10. I couldn't afford to talk with any other supportive people like family and loved ones. There are also other things that cost money in jail, like seeing the nurse if you need medications, canteen items, things like that. I was fortunate to be able to talk to my case manager, but I know a lot of people in jail nowadays don't have any money at all. They're flat broke. And a lot of people also stay in jail a lot longer than I did. Some of those people may have to choose between seeing the nurse, having medications, or contacting their case manager or therapist. I hope you will pass this bill to make it easier to access support for people who might be struggling with their mental health in the future going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony and for sharing your story with us. We really appreciate it.
Yep, you're very welcome.
We have Matt Freeman signed up to testify. Welcome to the committee, and go ahead and introduce yourself. Begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Freeman. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators and the Human Service Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I want to thank the bill author for working alongside counties to ensure that this bill in how it's implemented can be successful. My members appreciate the desire to expand discharge planning and reentry coordination services. We see great value in that. Want to make sure that how the language is written is not too prescriptive to prevent models that are existing or tailoring discharge plans to meet the needs of the individuals. Members also raised some concerns about the individuals who opt out of receiving discharge planning, knowing that an individual has an opportunity to decline service and ensuring that that's reflected in the language. And we will continue to work with the author to clarify some of that implementation. Lastly, counties feel it's really important for these type of programs that there is ongoing and sustainable funding to maintain the service costs going forward, and so appreciate the appropriation that's going to be included and ensuring that that will maintain the cost of the service going forward. So we look forward to continuing to work with the author and the committee, and happy to take any questions folks may have.
Thanks for your testimony. Any other members of the public who wish to testify? I'm not seeing any. And before we get to member discussion, we do have the A1 amendment, and I believe Representative Novotny, that's your amendment?
Yeah, that's correct, Chair Mueller.
All right, would you please describe your amendment to us?
It is truly a technical cleanup of the bill. The last line of the bill, as it stands, describes that the funding goes to 50% of the funding go outside of the metropolitan area, and it's small metropolitan and no definition. My amendment simply adds the definition and ties it into section 437.212, subdivision 2, which is the state statute definition of what a metropolitan area is per statute.
Thank you. Representative Curran, to the A1 amendment.
Yep, thank you, Lead Novotny, for the amendment. It's a great clarification, and I support it.
Any questions regarding the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Now we can move to member discussions on the bill as amended. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, this is being laid over, and so that's an explanation for why the appropriation hasn't been determined. But is there any sense of what that appropriation ultimately might end up being?
Representative Curran, Elliot, hi.
Thank you, Chair. Looking to phone a friend who might have a ballpark figure for us.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll look to the department, but we did hear an estimate that like each grant might be $150,000. I guess I'll clarify, too, that some programs would be maybe starting for the first time, so that could include staff, and that might be a higher level, and some would just be supporting what already exists, so I might not expect it to be that much, but that was the number that we heard from the department, 150 or 200 per grant.
Thank you, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many grants are we talking about? Is it per county?
L.A. Butai.
Representative Hudson, yes. I think it really just depends on how much money is put out there, and then it would be a request for proposal and just whoever applied and however it got handled, I think, would be above my pay grade maybe on that.
Yeah, and as you noted, we are laying this over, so we will make sure to get those numbers so we can have a full discussion about the fiscal impact. It's an important question.
Thank you.
Anything further? Further member comments? Representative Navan.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Reminded of a call I was on. I'd been called into our jail to address a person from another county that had been held, and it's almost like he read the bill from what he was telling me that his concerns were. He had told jail staff that as he was getting released that it was the middle of winter, he didn't have his meds, he didn't have transportation, he had no way to get back to Hennepin County where he lived, and his solution was that he was going to go rob a bank on a Saturday morning. And that's how the jail staff got involved, because he asked them what banks are open in Elk River on a Saturday, which was kind of funny until I started talking to him, and that was his plan, and his said his worst case scenario, it would be a suicide by cop, and then he wouldn't have to worry about it. Given this, it was a Saturday, given in the limited resources, I placed him on a 72-hour hold because I thought he was a threat to himself, and he was sent to the closest hospital in Anoka County, and there was directions, you know, that this needed to be taken care of. Well, he was released bright and early Monday morning and proceeded to walk out of the hospital and rob the first bank he could find. So really ties into the situation where we need to make that connection. You pull people away from all their support systems. Could have easily, you know, in this situation, no one was hurt, but could have easily been a situation where someone could have been hurt because there wasn't that connection there. So I speak in favor of this.
Thank you. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Curran, for bringing this. I just wanted to speak as the former author of the free calls for mental health concerns from last year. I just think this is a really important provision and something that is, every time I've talked to somebody about this, they've been shocked that it would cost money for somebody to get mental health care while they are in jail. And I think this is something that's just so fundamental to the care that we need to provide to people, regardless of where they are in this process, because it's, I mean, we have a mental health crisis for just those of us who are not going through things, right? Like just living in this like post-pandemic world. So when we're talking about people that are put into our care, we have a responsibility to take care of them and to make sure that they are getting the services that they need. So I really thank you for bringing this forward. I'm excited to support this.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Closing comments, Representative Kern.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, for the discussion. I appreciate all the support for this. Lead Novotny's example, I think, says it clearly. We have folks who are relying on the way that our system currently is because we don't have the things proposed in this bills in this bill. And so I really do think that the measures that we're taking here today and looking at help fill in some gaps where folks need some assistance in that transition. And I thank you for the supportive conversation.
Thank you. And thanks also to all your testifiers for being here today. We really appreciate it. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 824 as amended. The next bill we have on the agenda is a Representative Becker Finn bill, House File 1319. Give her a chance to get up to the table. And I believe that the motion is to refer House File 1319 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Oh, got it. Yes, Madam Chair, that is the motion.
Okay, and I do see that you have a DE2 amendment. Would you like to move your DE2 amendment?
Yep, I would move the DE2.
All right, and would you do you want to explain the amendment now, or is it?
Well, if I explain the amendment, I'll be explaining the entire bill. Right. So I think just getting the bill in the shape that it needs to be in would be great.
Great. Okay. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment is adopted. All right. Now, if you want to go ahead and explain your bill as amended.
Yes. So thank you, Chair Mueller. This is the MRRA, the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act. And really, this is a bit of a it's a big change for how we would do corrections in our state. But what we know, you know, if we look at recidivism rates, we know that the current system isn't working and isn't serving our constituents to the best that it can. And we'll mostly have a lot of folks from the Department of Corrections are here to walk through the bill in this kind of evidence-based way. But I mostly wanted to draw members' attention. Really, the heart of this bill to me is Section 5, which starts on line 4.12, 4.12 of the DE2. And it's this idea, and if you kind of scan down to the individualized rehabilitation plan. When I first started my work in this body, I served on the Public Safety Committee, and the very first presentation we have from the Department of Corrections as a domestic violence prosecutor, I was horrified at the idea that the work that we were doing as prosecutors and advocates on the outside, we would send somebody to prison and then they didn't receive any programming. There was nothing individualized to their specific situation. So here we have this opportunity where we've interrupted this cycle of violence. We have this person, they're incarcerated. It's this amazing opportunity to sort of right the ship and get people the services that they need so that they do not reoffend, so that they become full contributing members of our community. And the current system doesn't typically do that. Typically, it's a holding space for people, and that's not to undermine or to speak ill of some of the programs that do exist, but what this bill would do would really recognize that each individual person might need something different so that they can thrive when they come back to our communities. whether some folks like it or not, the way that our system works, we don't lock people up indefinitely. The vast majority of people are going to be returning to our communities, and this is a tool and a way we can change the way we see this system so that it's actually serving people who are incarcerated, but then the overall impacts on the full community are improved because that person has the tools, has gone through the training, the treatment that they need to get better. We know, we'll get into this with the presentation here, but you know, we know a lot of the statistics around folks as far as mental health issues, substance abuse, all those kinds of things. And so this individualized rehabilitation program, again, like for line 4.27, that is addressing the incarcerated person's needs and risk factors and their identified strengths. And I think that's really important if we want people to get better, if we do want to correct a wrong and not just punish people while they are incarcerated. And so with that, we do have a couple of presenters, so I want to make sure that we've got plenty of time for that, and we'll turn it over to Commissioner Schnell with the chair's guidance.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Penn. Welcome back to the committee. Commissioner Schnell, if you want to introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. Paul Schnell, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and I'm really pleased and thankful to Representative Chair Becker-Penn for bringing this bill forward. We believe that this is really a game-changing proposition. I would just remind people that this is what the Department of Corrections stands for. We are in the business of trying to transform lives, and that is fundamentally focused on the safety of our state. As Chair Becker-Penn mentioned, 95% of the people who are in our prisons are going to come back to communities across our state. And we stand in full recognition of the need for accountability for people who have engaged in wrongdoing in violation of the laws of our state. But we also have to recognize and do recognize that accountability without rehabilitation is a failed proposition. And this is, I think, what the MRRA, Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, is all about. In our current system, people serve two-thirds of their sentence in prison and one-third is on supervised release. So, generally speaking, people are going to leave prison at 67%, regardless of what they've done. Now, I just want to make an example of this, if I can, and with the chair's permission, I'll use her and I as the examples here. But if the chair and I were to both be sentenced to a 100-month prison sentence in today's terms, and we started on the same day, we would serve 67 months in prison and 33 months on supervised release. Now, the proposition, let's change this proposition and say that, the chair, as I would expect and anticipate, would do very well when she got in there. And she did all the things that she needed to do to reduce her risk and address her needs. I, on the other hand, was a problem. I fought, I pushed back, I did not participate in programming, which you might also expect to be the case. But I think this is an important thing because today in our system, regardless of the fact that the chair did well and I did poorly, we are still going to walk out of prison the very same day. And does that make sense? The chair has done what was needed to reduce her risk and address her needs. I, on the other hand, didn't. Now, I still have the protections of a determinant sentencing system. I'm going to walk out at 67%. That's 67 months, and the chair would as well. What MRRA does is it changes that proposition and says we want to incentivize, we want people who go into our prison system to walk out better, to be in a better place, in a better position. And so the proposition is all about how do we incent people to do the good stuff, to do the things that are going to make a difference. This results in reduction of risk, fewer victims, safer prisons, and healthier communities. There are four components to this system, and I'm just going to really briefly go over them. First, and the chair mentioned this, is about the creation of this individualized rehabilitation plan. Historically, what happened when people came in, you did the programs that the prison system offered. And I will say that we have some very, very good programs in our system. But we didn't target that based upon on the individual's needs or strengths. And this is really one of the key factors here. What is it that Paul Schnell needs? What is it that the chair needs? And how do we address that? What are our strengths? What do we bring to this? And we need to build on that to produce this. So we do robust assessment that ultimately identifies and addresses the kind of the needs and strengths and risk factors. And then we target interventions in a person-centered sort of way to move forward. So component number one, individualized rehabilitation plan. Component number two is this notion of earned incentive release. What we want to do is provide that opportunity for, in this case, because the chair did so well, she could leave prison at 50 months, 5-0. And I, on the other hand, would remain for the entirety of the determinant sentence, 67 months. And so earned incentive release, and the chair did that by participating and fully completing the programs that were laid out in that plan. Third component is that, so the chair now has realized that earned incentive release opportunity at 50 months. Just as the case would be, and normally, that she would move into supervised release. But what we want to do is we want to continue this process of how do we continue to incent her to do the things that are going to make a difference for the safety of our state and for the community and for her family. And so what we provide here is the opportunity for earned supervision abatement. And I want to also just place emphasis on the fact that we are talking here about earned. This is not a give. This is an earn. And that becomes a really key consideration. So supervision abatement, so when the chair goes out and does well in the community, does aftercare, engages with her faith-based community, whatever it may be, all the things, does ongoing counseling, work with the family, reintegration plans, and so forth, she, for every 2 months that she does and follows that plan, 1 month goes into abatement status. So in this case, what happened, an abatement status is effectively unsupervised release. And so she would be out there, and if there was potentially a relapse or something like that, the system can re-engage with her and address that during that abatement period. But effectively, as long as things are going well, she is completed supervision from an active supervision standpoint at 22 months, saving 11 months of supervision time. Why is that important and valuable? It's invaluable because, you know, I am going to come out at 67 months. And when I come out, my needs may be considerably higher. Those needs around supervision and tracking and services that a probation officer may be able to provide me, that really isn't necessary for the chair because she has done well. She's demonstrated those skills. So that's the third component, supervision abatement. The last component, and an important one, is this notion of justice reinvestment. What we want to do is, because the chair was in prison for 17 months less than I was, because she earned that incentivized release, we take the direct cash costs of that 17-month savings, we place that into an account, and on a biennial basis, those funds get distributed out in these four categories at 25% each. Victim services. At the same time we're investing in opportunities for transformation for people who are in our system, we want to make sure that we're also providing resources and benefits to people who have been the victims of crime and need that opportunity for support and healing. And we'll hear more about that from others. Second, we want to make sure that supervision services, because of my need and those sorts of things, we want to make sure that these dollars are going back out, 25% go back out to the services and supports that are necessary for our probation and supervision folks around the state. Third component is really about prevention. We want to take up 25% of these dollars, and we want to invest in upstream prevention. How do we ultimately keep people from coming into the system in the first place? And finally, the last 25% goes back to the state's general fund as a dividend to taxpayers. And we think that this is also important. So all this model does is it compares and contrasts the current system against what we're proposing with the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act. And you can see the gray box at the end accounts for the savings that were realized because of the earning of this time that the chair had. And so really the chair and members, the focus here is really not on how much time people are in prison, but how they use that time. How they spend that time becomes the critical component. We know that there can be a lot of derivatives of this program. We can look at some of the statistics that we have here, and Dr. Grant Dewey is with me today, and he will just talk about some of these things as he gets into this. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Dewey.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Dewey. And if you want to introduce yourself, then begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Grant Dewey. I'm Research Director for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. As Commissioner Schnell has indicated, we think of MRRA as evidence-based correctional reform, and my testimony this morning will focus on reviewing some of the evidence on which MRRA is based. And let me take us back one slide.
Yep.
Okay.
It worked.
So what? As the topic of prison reform has attracted growing interest and concern, especially over the last decade, one of the criticisms that frequently gets leveled against prison systems, including the one here in Minnesota, is that they don't do a very good job of rehabilitating people. Nationwide, we see five-year rearrest rates are close to 80%. One of the things that we do see is that even if we're able to modestly improve those recidivism rates, that would have a big impact on costs. We've estimated that even reducing our three-year re-imprisonment rate by one percentage point, that it would reduce costs to the DOC by more than $5 million. But the costs of crime are not borne exclusively by the Department of Corrections. We see that crime is very costly. There's a cost to law enforcement, the courts, victimization costs, lost productivity costs, and when we factor in all of those, a one percentage point reduction in recidivism would result in almost $58 million in costs avoided to the state. Now, some of the research that's been done, including some that we've done, indicates that there are some parts of prison that are criminogenic, meaning that when people go into prison, it makes them more likely to recidivate after they get released. And one of those components that we've identified is when people get warehoused, when they go into prison, they don't participate in prison labor or programming, they're idle for the entirety of their confinement period. That makes recidivism outcomes worse. It increases the risk of recidivism by 13%. Now, how prevalent is warehousing? How big of a problem is that? Well, the data that we have show that since 2010, 20% of all releases were warehoused. Now, even when people aren't warehoused for 100% of their confinement period, we still see that for everyone else, there's still a lot of time that's spent in prison not participating in programming or working. We see about half of people's time in prison is spent working or being involved in programming. The other half, they're spent idle. So idleness becomes a problem when we start looking at the safety of our correctional facilities and the health and well-being of those who live there and work there. Our research indicates that when people are idle and they're not participating in programming or working, it significantly increases the risk for frequent and violent misconduct. Now, we just wrapped up a five-year study with researchers from Florida State University who were, and this was a project funded by the federal government, and this project looked at stress among correctional officers. And this was a study that focused on COs in three of our facilities, Stillwater, Faribault, and Shakopee, the women's facility. And what the researchers found is that stress was associated, well, working as a correctional officer is already a stressful job. But what the researchers found is that stress levels among COs were significantly higher at Stillwater in comparison to Faribault and Shakopee. And rates of idleness are significantly higher at Stillwater than they are at Faribault and Shakopee. And what the researchers also found is that stress was associated with significantly worse mental and physical health outcomes. And so what this data suggests is when people aren't working, when they aren't involved in programming, it makes our facilities less safe, but also it has an impact on the people who work there and the people who live there. Now, idleness and involvement in programming and working also has an impact on post-release outcomes. So when we look at the impact of programming on recidivism, we see that when people complete just one intervention in prison, it reduces recidivism by 12%. If they're able to do two interventions, we see a 26% reduction. Three interventions, 30%. Going up to five interventions, we see more than a 40% reduction. Now, the focus a lot of times is on recidivism. And there's good reason for that, but there are other post-release outcomes that are just as important, if not more so. We see that when people are involved in programming or working while they're in prison, it improves post-release employment outcomes. So when we look at people who are warehoused, they're idle for 100% of their time in prison versus people who are working or involved in programming 50%. That improved their odds of post-release employment within that first year by 15%. But it's not just employment that matters. We started looking at mortality outcomes for people who have been released from prison since 2010. We've been able to get data from the Minnesota Department of Health. And what those data tell us is when people are involved in programming or working, that it has an impact on lifespan after they get released from prison. The more people are involved in programming or working, going again from 0% to 50%, it reduces risk of mortality by 15% for all causes and 10% for unnatural deaths, meaning deaths, homicide victimization, suicide, overdoses, accidents. So what people do while they're in prison, what they're able to access and do, it has an impact on safety, health, well-being of people who live and work there. It has an impact on recidivism, has an impact on employment, and it has an impact on mortality. Now, I've focused so far on just how much programming people get while they're in prison, and that's important. And we realize that we need to make a greater investment in our programming resources, which is reflected in our budget request. But it's also important to emphasize that we're not just talking about giving people just something to do. We're talking about providing more people with quality programming to do, because that is key, and some of the results that I've shared reflect the fact that there are effective interventions and programs that do take place within the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and I've listed some of these here. But at this point, I would like to turn it back over to Commissioner Schnell to wrap things up.
Thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, we're done here. We're just about done here. But we point out, and I think to put this in context, when we really think about the concerns that certainly have been on the tops of minds of all of you, of Minnesotans, some of the concerns that have been raised in recent times about violent crime, I think we have to really recognize the fact that we are talking about a small percentage of the population. That said, the impact of these crimes is pronounced, and we all know that. And that's why doing right by, doing well by these people while they're in our care, custody, and control, and that continues throughout the continuum. The remainder of their sentence on supervision becomes critically important, and I would go back to the reality that incentives work. I would point out that even in 2018, the U.S. government, on a bipartisan basis, passed the First Step Act, was signed into law by President Trump, which was really an incentive-based reform practice. And I think what we're saying here is that we cannot be corrections in name only. That what we're proposing with this model is that we're corrections in practice. And that, I think, is what this is all about. And we are really grateful for the time, and we're grateful to the chair for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next on the list, we have Kevin Reese, and on deck, we have Shanika Chambers. So if you both want to make your way down, that would be great. I don't see Mr. Reese here. Okay. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello, Chair Moeller and members of the Public Safety Committee. My name is Shanika Chambers, and I'm a policy program manager for Violence Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse. We are a statewide coalition with over 80 member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victims across the state. I am testifying in support of the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act. Historically, the view has been that victim safety is maximized by increasing punishments for offenders, and we as a coalition have helped to advance that thinking. But in working with our programs, listening to victim survivors, and looking at our intimate partner homicide data, we learned that accountability solely based on incarceration without changed behavior does not keep victims and communities safe. Victim safety is actually enhanced with good criminal legal system reform. We know that many victim survivors remain in relationship with the person who used violence. They may have children with them or are financially tied to them. In these situations and in many others, what victims want is for the violence to stop and the behavior to change. Victim survivors have told us they want their abusers to have access to resources and education that could transform their behavior while incarcerated. And that overall, there is too much focus on criminalization and incarceration and too little on offering supports to address the abusers' behaviors while they are under correctional control. It is also true that some incarcerated abusers will go on to have intimate partner relationships with other victims, and without intervention, they will likely abuse again. In fact, every year in our annual domestic violence homicide report, we see at least one homicide where the perpetrator has a history of abuse. They serve time in jail or prison, and then they proceeded to commit a new crime or homicide against a new victim. If we don't take opportunity to change a person's behaviors and patterns while they are incarcerated, there will likely be another victim. The reality is that a vast majority of incarcerated people will eventually be released and returned to their communities, and sometimes to the same family unit that they left from. If simply serving time in jail or prison does not change a person's behavior, how do we hold people accountable for using violence in ways that will? The Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act is a reform measure that asks those very questions and looks to advance reforms along those lines. It includes things like domestic abuse transformation programming to change violent behavior. It includes support services for victim survivors to address safety needs, and it addresses the success of reentry questions like how do we reintegrate people back into their families and communities. We are grateful that the MRRA will reinvest savings into crime victim services, and believe that investing in these community-based programs are necessary in order to make any meaningful shifts in our criminal legal system. Finally, I want to highlight that we have historically spoken about victimization and perpetration as two wholly separate and distinct populations, and that is false. National statistics show that as much as 97% of some female populations report prior histories of victimization. Violence Free Minnesota interviewed 62 Native American women at the Shakopee Correctional Facility about their histories of victimization and the criminal legal system. All but one of those women had extensive histories of violence and abuse prior to their incarceration. Clearly, many of those within our prisons have histories of victimization that need to be addressed, as well as if we are serious about ending cycles of violence and criminal justice system involvement. If we're going to stop cycles of violence and abuse, we need reforms within our corrections. Our coalition, along with other crime victim coalitions, have been included in the reform conversations with the Department of Corrections, and Violence Free Minnesota supports the MRA bill. Thank you. MRRA bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate it. And we did get word that Mr. Reese was unable to be here today. Then I think we have one member of the public who signed up to testify, Professor Will Cooley, if you want to come make your way to the table. And if you can keep your testimony short, we want to make sure we have robust discussion among our members. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Mohler, members of the committee, my name is Will Cooley, professor at Metropolitan State University. The Minnesota Rehabilitation Reinvestment Act has many aspects that reward positive actions rather than just punishing negative behaviors. Today I want to focus on how it can be used to prevent violence. Through earned supervision abatement, agents can lower their active caseloads and focus on those crucial first few months of a person being released from prison, a time when we know that releasees are at the most danger of being the victims of crime, overdosing, or recidivating. I saw this in action through the Priorities Bureau in Canton, Ohio. The commander of the Priorities Bureau, John Gabbard, a police lieutenant, set up a program to find out who was returning from prison to the city, and coordinated with community supervision agents to make sure that the reentry went smoothly. Sometimes the lieutenant even visited inmates while they were locked up to figure out what they needed when they got back to Canton. The Priorities Bureau helped connect people to jobs, housing, and social services. However, a drawback was that they could not reach all the people who were being released. Parole officer caseloads were so large that they were often unable to give their attention to reentry issues, and some releasees slipped through the cracks. Each parole officer had approximately 76 clients when that number should have been around 50. One of these cases had tragic results. Lieutenant Gabbard had planned to coordinate a supervised release meeting with Christopher Trent, who was released from prison February 15, 2016, after serving 9 months for assault. But agents were so tied up with their excessive caseloads that it did not happen. On February 27th, less than 2 weeks after being released, a spray of bullets claimed the lives of Christopher Trent, age 40, and his brother Alan Trent, age 42, in the parking lot of an apartment complex in Canton. Like many law enforcement officers, Lieutenant Gabbard was haunted by this missed opportunity. He believed that if the supervision planning meeting had happened, Trent may have lived. I'm sure many of the members here with law enforcement experience know that feeling. Perhaps he was being too hard on himself. Law enforcement officers can only do so much. But we can assist innovative officers like Lieutenant Gabbard through smarter policies and practices. Currently, supervision agents in Minnesota are forced to spend too much of their time on people who have been out of prison for years and reintegrated into society. Instead, through the incentive programs of the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, they can focus on these initial high-risk days and months and create safer communities. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Any other members of the public who wish to testify? All right. Mr. Flowers, welcome back to the committee. You can keep your testimony to 90 seconds. We appreciate it. Nice to see you.
Me with 90 seconds.
Please introduce yourself again for us.
No, I'm just going to say I support investing in what Commissioner Snell is talking about. But what I'm not hearing is about a lot of county home schools for juveniles, for young people, have been closed over the state, all in Hennepin County and Ramsey and the state. And I'm concerned that we want to try to keep young people out of prison. So when you're talking about this, Commissioner, I want to put a focus on that. Right now, they're letting kids, they let them out of jail. Ain't nowhere to put them. And we don't want them incarcerated, but we have to figure out, this got to be directed toward these juveniles that the courts don't have nowhere to put them because the county are closing home schools all over. So I would ask this committee to really look at that while you putting this together about this reinvestment, about kids, about juveniles. And then having people, I know people have stayed with me that came out of incarceration, and they didn't want to go to the halfway house. So I know a lot about this. I might look like I know a lot about everything, but this right here is important to me. What you're saying here today, and I want to hear about the juveniles. How we gonna save them before they go to prison? Because they will go to prison if you keep letting them out and have these incidents happen over and over again. I know people been to jail, get out with felt with weapons, and they're getting out of jail now. And it's going to cost us in our community. I continue to say, speaking up for the African-American community, and since I want to be respectful to Chair Mulder's comment of 90 seconds, I hope I didn't go too far past that. And thank you, and I will talk to Commissioner Snell about that, too.
Yes.
But you keep it on your mind, too. Thank you.
Great. If you could just, for your record, just say your name, please, so we have that on the recording.
Al Flowers.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah, and I would just note, too, that we started to hear some bills related specifically to juveniles. And if you haven't connected yet with Vice Chair Feist, she is working on a whole host of bills related to juveniles, and we will be hearing those in committee. So please take the opportunity to connect with her as well.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? All right, not seeing anybody else, we can move now to member discussion. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This might be a question for Commissioner Schnell or the bill author, but I'm actually looking here on line C here. 513 and 514.
Go ahead and ask
after
your
the
question.
DE, this is based off of the felony level crime against a person that would constitute compliance credits expired or executed. If that were to take place and it's a gross misdemeanor or a misdemeanor not against a person, would that not apply to?
Can you clarify? Right? Are you working off the DE amendment or the original bill?
No, I'm on the original. I apologize.
Okay.
All right, great. Representative, if you want to point us to the DE, which line?
Yeah.
Or maybe we could go back once you find it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll come back to you. All right.
Where's the DE?
Anybody else wanting to? Oh, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Becker-Fenn.
Representative Hudson, I'm having trouble hearing you. I don't know, your mic is right there, but
yeah, I'm a little under the weather today, so I'm
sorry about that. All right.
Not as boisterous as I typically am. So you know, this bill gets me thinking, which probably indicates that you're onto something and you're over a target. This is a problem that a lot of us have recognized, and I think, to be frank, your side of the aisle has done more thinking about than ours has about how we get people from being incarcerated to being productive members of society on the other side of that experience. What I'm concerned about as I look through this bill is the amount of discretion that the commissioner appears to have and the staff when it comes to developing these individualized rehabilitation plans. And I'm wondering if there's been any thought put into defining that more clearly and placing some guardrails around it so that it doesn't become a mechanism for some discrimination that we haven't conceived of. Because if you were able to craft a plan for this person that requires one set of things, a plan for this person that requires a different set of things, and there was some bias in there into what was informing your requirements, it could end up having a disparate impact on how their sentences end up playing out.
Representative Becker-Fenn.
Yeah, I thank you for the question. I think, you know, it's always sort of this balancing act that we're trying to do where you want to be descriptive enough that it's clear that we're pointing to things that work, and at the same time not limiting ourselves to things that might work for that one person. So I think it is hard to figure out, you know, because you don't want to put it into statute in a way that limits a program that might actually work for a person. And I know overall the department has been working with all kinds of outside stakeholders, and we do, when it comes to the Earn Incentive Release Credit, you know, we do, you know, name all these organizations that they would be consulting with and be required to consult with. So, I mean, I appreciate the question. I mean, we want to be doing this in the best way that we can. And I don't know if the commissioner has more to add to that.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. I think it's a spot-on question. And one of the things that we're mindful of, I would just say that there is a reporting requirement here, and that was one of the key things, because we know that this has to come back. You're the policymakers for our state, and it has to come back to you, and there should be oversight. We want to get this right. This is really important. I think, you know, Dr. Dewey would often talk about the First Step Act, and one of the challenges, certainly COVID got in the way of that, because it was going to start in 2019. That's the federal system that was put into place, and there isn't a lot of data yet on that, but programming was an issue. There's also another statutory provision requiring us to make sure that we're addressing issues that would create racial disparities, and that is a statutory direction that exists in the legislature for our agency, and it is something that we are very mindful of and we will report on. I do understand that we are asking for a lot of latitude to develop this model. We do not want people to fail when they leave. That really is the goal, and we want to be able to report our progress. This is a massive change for our state, and yet we believe it's the right one if public safety is our core concern.
Representative Hudson, any follow-up?
Yeah, just shifting course a little bit, going back to the evidence that was outlined for us by your colleague, mm-hmm. Where is that coming from? So have these types of policies been implemented elsewhere, and is that where you're getting your information from?
Looks like Dr. Dewey's coming back to the table, so go ahead, Dr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, most of the research that I referenced has been published in peer-reviewed academic journals. So we have done that for as long as I've been at the agency, which has been about 18 years. It's not something we're required to do, but we do it because we think it improves the quality of the research that we do, but then it also, we think it makes the research that we do more objective and credible. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
Representative Becker Finn has a comment.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, I know in a PowerPoint it's hard to have your citations, but I know as an attorney, and I assume as a doctor, as a researcher, you know, I do like to read the underlying studies to actually see how that relates. So I'm sure that we can get those citations and get that information to folks, because it is important that we have that underlying information.
Anything further, Representative Hudson?
Just to say I would appreciate that, because knowing the methodology and knowing where the information came from, it's extremely helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ingen, I'll go back to you now.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at victim input, and we want to make sure that victims are brought to the table on this. We've heard a number of bills about victims and making sure that they're given the resources that they need to be able to, A, deal with the trauma that they experienced, but also know that the future is going to be better, that they're not going to be re-victimized. And I'm looking on 5-6 through 5-8, some of those lines there. What if a victim just simply does not want their assailant to be on release? What if there's a reasonable effort made to even connect with the victim, but nobody is reached, nobody is spoken to, and some of those safeguards that should be in place for their knowledge, for their benefit, aren't actually made aware to them?
Commissioner Schnell?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is one of the areas I think that we were particularly mindful of as we developed this model. And it comes out of the experience of in the parole model today with life sentence cases, is that oftentimes the first time the surviving family is contacted by the system after sentencing is 27 years after when the first parole hearing happens. And imagine that call. And so the thing that we're trying to do here is create a system as we bring people in to engage with the victims. And one of the ways we do that is through every county attorney's office across the state has a victim witness assistance program. And we want to make sure that as people come into the system, we're connecting more directly there. And then we do have, you know, notification systems that people can register for. Not everyone does. I think you raise a great point. It's one of the things that we feel really strongly we need to improve systemically through the connection with victim witness. And I think as it relates to, you know, does the victim in a case have, quote-unquote, trumping rights? That does not exist here. I think one of the issues that we need, if we can do a better job of connecting so that the last, you know, oftentimes we see victims as though they're standing on the steps of the courthouse and all of a sudden something is happening 7 years, 6 years later. And we need to make sure there's a stronger continuity and connection there. And we believe that this was put specifically into the bill because we want to make sure that it's explicit, that it's an obligation of ours, and that part of this is also around making sure we're not just doing notification, but we're really talking about how do we do wraparound services, how do we connect. We have a victim services unit. We're working with victim service providers across Minnesota, and we think that this can be managed much better and serve the needs of victims far better. At least have them understand, and then where there are any concerns that they would naturally have, these people experience real harm. We want to make sure that we're doing our part as a system, whether it's through community-based advocacy programs or the DOC, to provide the kinds of wraparound safety and security things that can just go a long way with victims. But I would also say this, that we hear over and over, and I think as the testifier from Violence Free Minnesota mentioned, we hear over and over the fact that when all is said and done, the last thing victims want is these people to come out and not have received the kinds of services that are going to reduce their risk of reoffending and harming someone else.
Thank you. Representative Beckerman.
Yeah, thank you. And I did want to point out in this section, I think it's important that it's a victim input and not just victim notification. You know, historically, a lot of areas in our criminal statutes just require notification, and this is actually requiring input. Further, it's on line 5.10, the commissioner must consider all victim input. And I think that's really key, too, where we might have a situation with multiple victims that there is a requirement that everybody who's impacted in that way, they're what they want must be considered. And I also want to say, you know, we haven't totally gotten into this, I think, yet in this committee. But so I worked for several years exclusively as a prosecutor focusing on domestic violence crimes. And when I first came into that job, you know, you sort of have this idea that you're going to be this like champion for victims, and you have this idea and these assumptions about what victims want. And the reality, and what I even came to grow and change my perspective over time in doing the work, is that it isn't, sometimes it's counterintuitive to those of us who aren't experiencing that person's individual situation. And so I think it's really important that even when we're well-intentioned, and I know I've done this too, where you're well-intentioned and you think you're doing the right thing in speaking for victims, that we need to let them speak for themselves. And so I think listening to that testimony from Violence Free is really important. The people experiencing violence best know how to keep themselves alive. They best know how to survive their situations. We don't. They know their individual situation better than any of us will ever know. And so I think I just really want to lift up their perspective when they tell us with their own voices what it is that they want and need, that we're always listening to that.
And I'll just note, too, looking at Section 6 for the Earned Incentive Release Credit stakeholder input, on lines 5.25 to 5.28, you have four of the victim advocacy organizations, which is highly unusual. Often in these bills, we'll put one representative for a victim or one victim advocacy organization. And so I'm really appreciative that you included all four in this. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. No, and I think we're on the same page when it comes to letting victims speak for themselves. We really should let them tell their story. But my concern is that it's a subjective sense of considering whether or not their input should actually be instituted into that plan for the person who's incarcerated. You know, if we just listen, and they must take that input, but they're not going to be actually instituting anything that's different under that plan. Really, it's just kind of allowing the victim to be heard rather than giving them an outcome that not only improves their mental health and physical health and peace of mind after being victimized, but it doesn't necessarily grant the subjectivity of the program any credence with the public. How does the public come to trust this if a victim isn't necessarily always taken into account just beyond consideration?
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you. And I would say this is a better situation than what victims currently have. Our current system doesn't even require this. So I think that's really important that this is an improvement. I'm not saying that any bill that any of us do is going to be perfect. And I think, again, that's the instructiveness of that report. You know, if we hear back that things aren't going well or we can improve, then we're going to do that. But I think this is already giving more credence to victims than what the current system does. So I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind. You know, certainly if there's ideas of ways we can make bills better, this is why we have the committee process. No bill is perfect when it's first introduced. You know, certainly this is our second crack at it. That's why it's a DE2. You know, we've been working on this for a couple years now. But I appreciate the sentiment, and I do think it's important to lift up the role of victims in this whole process.
Representative Devotny.
Thank you, and this will probably be directed to Chair Snell or Commissioner Snell. Under the distribution reallocation of funds under Subdivision 4, you've got 25% going to the Department of Corrections for grants to develop and invest in community-based services, including individuals at risk of becoming involved in the criminal justice system. Approximately, what's the ballpark number on that? What's that transfer going to be, and what are the plans for administering that grant? And is this the right place if we're dealing with individuals that are not part of the Direction of Corrections, the Department of Corrections yet, under your supervision? Should the money be going there, or should it be going more towards a different account that's more community based?
Madam Chair, Lee Devotny, if there's a better option, we certainly would be open to that. There, you know, we've had some conversations, like as a, for instance, with the Office of Justice Programs, who already delivers funding for both prevention and for victim services. If that's the best vehicle, we certainly are open to that. This is not about trying to retain the dollars. It's really about wanting to make sure they get to where they go. And if that's an easier way because they already have a established process, we're fully open to that.
Representative, we're going to wrap up pretty soon.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Yep. And just a quick, what's the ballpark guess on that transfer, 25%?
Commissioner?
So, Madam Chair, Lee Devotny, this has been, you know, we part of the thing we don't know. We do believe that, you know, this has the ability to look at on a biennial basis. So this is going to take time to ramp up. Maybe it's $10 to $15 million biennially over the long haul as we get into this. Now, I don't want to overpromise, because this is a process to develop, but that becomes real money when we start looking at that, being able to go back in. And this is direct cash costs. We're not talking here about the fully burdened per diem rate.
Representative Bonney.
Thank you, Chair. And that's just my concern. Yes, that it does have looks like it's going to be a pretty good pot of money. I just want to make sure that that's being watched after. And thank you.
Yep. Closing comments, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and I want to thank you for giving us the time to really dig into this bill. This is really important and could really sort of change our state in a really good way moving forward. So I appreciate the full testimony and discussion and being able to talk about these issues with all of you. Ideally, years into this, when this is working, that pot of money is going to get smaller because there's going to be fewer people recidivating. And I'll just close with, you know, we talk about recidivism, and it's really important to have the data and look at those studies and look at those numbers, and we can kind of like nerd out on like seeing recidivism as a clinical number, but the reality is that every time we prevent a crime from happening, that is one, you know, that's a fewer people impacted as victims, fewer families being impacted, and we really can't put a cost on all of the things, all the good things that could come from this bill when we finally move it forward. So just thank you for giving us the latitude and the time today, Chair Mueller.
Thank you. Representative Becker-Finn renews her motion that House File 1319, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Great. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1355. It is my bill, but it's also a public safety. Commissioner Schnell will be presenting it and his staff, and so I'm just going to keep the gavel in the sake of interest and time. So I will move that House File 1355 be recommended to be placed on the general register. I do have an author's amendment, the A3 amendment, and that amendment, I will move the amendment. It clarifies the some language that was inadvertently left out in the original draft. It clarifies the arrest warrant authority we're requesting in the bill. It adds Colton's Law back in that was inadvertently removed, and it includes language clarifying the statute on conditional medical release for future pandemics. Is there any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted. And then I have one other amendment, members. It's the A2 amendment. And this was a separate policy bill from the Department of Corrections. We wanted to just combine this so that we had one policy bill. It's House File 1483. And it provides that community supervising agents are added to the list of those eligible for line of duty death benefits. Any discussion to the A2? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. All right, and with that, the bill as amended is before us. Commissioner Schnell, would you like to describe the bill? And if we can do it, it's a lot, but let's go for it. And please introduce yourself again.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Paul Schnell, Commissioner of Corrections. And I will go through this quickly. Really much of this is a combination of several technical and clarifying modernizing changes to statutes governing the DOC's work, and I'll just walk through them. First, the bill creates the statutory requirement that the department have a language access plan. We want to thank Vice Chair Feist for carrying this bill last year. Currently, there is no requirement for the DOC to have a language access plan in place for its facilities and for individuals under its supervision who have limited English proficiency. And we have been working toward implementing this policy, but we do believe that this should be built into statute as we go forward. A second component, this also bill also repeals an unused statute focused on community intensive supervised release program. This is a distinct statute from intensive supervised release, which continues today. This is a law that that statute that has not been operational since 1995, oftentimes confused with intensive supervised release. And one of the goals of this was antiquated program was to punish the offender, which is not in alignment with the mission of us or our supervision partners across the state, which has been really more focused on rehabilitation and community re-engagement. In addition, the model was used as a justification for how ISR operates, which was mainly focused on surveillance, which led to poor outcomes instead of using evidence-based intervention practices. As important to note, the amendment that you all just passed ensures that the portion of the law known as Colton's Law is maintained. It was not our intention to do that. It was a mistake as we were doing some drafting. Colton Law, just so people know, requires electronic monitoring device to be placed on people under phase one of intensive supervised release, or ISR, before they are released from custody, so that they actually leave the facility with that electronic monitoring capability in place. The next provision in the bill is an automatic mechanism to shift funding when a county requests that its supervision delivery system change. Currently, when a county chooses, and I want to emphasize it's a county choice, to have the DOC provide supervision services, the statutory structure does not allow for those appropriated funds to come to the DOC, who would now be providing those services. Instead, it has to go to the general fund, and we need to make a separate request. These dollars were already appropriated for community supervision in that particular county, and when that county makes the switch, we are simply asking that those funds remain in the community supervision bucket, and just the agency is allowed to use that to cover the cost of providing supervision in that county. The next one updates updates substance use disorder treatment standards of care, and these align directly with the community standards and the Department of Human Services waiver. It directs and provides incarcerated individuals to complete SUD treatment without consideration of the SUD recommendations that are necessary in order to place people in the appropriate treatment settings, reflects best practices, and allows for easier access to care upon release. It modernizes the statute and brings us in line with best practices. Next provision really simply allows the Department of Corrections to electronically file disposition of detainer paperwork to the court and the prosecutor. Current statute requires the use of certified mail. This bill modernizes the process and allows us to use systems that exist. The next bill provides the DOC with the authority to issue a warrant when an individual who has been given a report date to prison does not comply with that. Under current authority, we do not have that access because they are not in DOC custody, which is one of the requirements under the law. So they fall in this provision of a warrant for commitment has been issued with a future date, which we do not have them in our custody. And so they still remain in this quandary. Are they under court's jurisdiction or are they under DOC jurisdiction? This bill really allows us to issue a warrant to get that person into custody in the rare occasions when an individual fails to report. The next provision is allows the operation of a challenged incarceration program at the state's only women's facility. The current statute allows those to operate only at Togo and Moose Lake. However, for the past 6 years, we've been providing challenged incarceration or boot camp programming at Shakopee in order to make sure that women have access to that program as well. But the statute does not specifically name Shakopee, and what this does essentially effectively just brings the statute in alignment to make sure that there is equal access to these programs across the state. The next one just clarifies membership on the Advisory Council for Interstate Commission for Adult Offender Supervision and the Interstate Commission for Juveniles. Both of these interstate compacts that we are involved in, and Chair Mueller, I carried this bill, passed off the House floor previously, but it brings both the adult and juvenile interstate compact into alignment. And however, current statutory language for both bodies is vague and in regard to who specifically must serve on that councils, and this modernizes and brings us into compliance with all federal requirements that are mandated. And we've already talked about the issues related to the amendments. I would just point out that there is the ability here for us to move place juveniles who may be certified as an adult and normally would go to this kind of awkward space of a youthful offender programming, would allow us, when that is deemed appropriate, to take that person who is under age 18 and allow them to be placed in youth specific program at Red Wing during that portion of time. And I think, as mentioned, the state bringing into line state death benefits, this really allows for God forbid it ever happens, but it would allow for people who are providing supervision across our state to be included in the state's line of duty death benefits, and other non-uniform staff working in the prisons, a teacher, a nurse, others who could be subjected to that situation. We want to make sure that there is the ability for them to access this benefit as they are providing a direct service to people who are in the state's care, custody, and control. Madam Chair, I believe that covers the issues in the bill. If there's anything else I can clarify, stand for questions.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. And I'll just note, too, that a big chunk of this bill is just showing what the interstate compact is. I carried that bill last year, like you said, and really the changes to the compact are very minor, but because we're making changes to the compact, we have to include the whole compact in the language, so it makes it look like something a lot more extensive than it is. I do have a question. So can you speak to, it's my understanding that MMB said that there would not be a fiscal note on this. Could you speak to that, please?
Madam Chair, yes, we have consulted. These are really things that either are happening now or the slight variations that we have already built into our operations. And so there is no fiscal note for the implementation. These really provide a broad range of I think, policy direction and modernization from the legislature to the department.
Thank you. And before we move to member discussion, I should ask, are there any public members who wish to testify? All right, I'm not seeing any. And we do have an A1 amendment. Representative Tabke, would you like to move and explain your amendment, please?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I will move the A1 amendment. And what this is Shakopee Prison is in, correctional facility is in my community, in my district. And I have gotten a significant number of letters and information from those incarcerated there. And the challenge program that we just talked about, Commissioner Schnell just talked about, is a really great program. And it has basically right now, if you get removed from the program for any reason, you cannot get back in. And what the amendment does is allows for folks who have been removed from the program access to the program again to get back in challenge. And it has been, I've talked to employees at the Shakopee Correctional Facility and Department of Corrections, and so everyone has agreed that it's a really good thing to move forward with.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to mention that I also received a lot of letters about this, and I think it's a really great idea, and I'm so glad that you brought this amendment.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. And now we can move on to member discussion of the bill as amended. Right. Not seeing anything. I would normally have closing comments, but I don't. Thank you so much, Commissioner, for walking us through that quickly, but we really appreciate it. And with that, I ask for your support, and I will renew my motion. I'm gonna make sure I get this right. That House File 1355, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the motion prevails. I went back to amendments again because we had so many. Thank you, everybody, for your participation today. Thank you to all of our testifiers for being here. And with that, we are adjourned.